a speech given by the world-renowned chimpanzee expert Jane Goodall as part of the Bixby series. The title is Population and Conservation. It was given in 2006 on May the 6th.
Oh, thank you, Malcolm, and good afternoon to everyone. And I think at this point, after Malcolm's remarks about our closest living relatives, the chimpanzees, maybe a chimpanzee greeting would be in order. So, that means... That just means hello. While I was just sitting here this afternoon, I thought of a nursery rhyme that I'm sure many of us heard when we were children. I couldn't remember the end of it, so Mary Lewis, who's with me, she said, I'll go and Google it, because I wondered if this might be a kind of nursery rhyme that tells us a story very applicable to what's going on in the world today. And it's this one. There was an old woman who lived in a shoe. She had so many children, she didn't know what to do. She gave them some broth without any bread. She whipped them all soundly and put them to bed. Well, that's where we are. Mother Earth is running out of food for the children, and the whipping will take the place of more and more hunger, disease, as overpopulation spirals, if we can't stop it. And as we've seen, there are trends towards a less prolific birth rate around the world, which is really lucky. But as we've also heard, the spiral is still going up. So we have to make even harder efforts to make sure that in certain parts of the world, the spiral is coming down. Chimpanzees are closest living relatives. We share about, we share 98.8% or 99.2%, depending on whose analysis you follow. We share that number of our genes with them, our DNA. And the recent unraveling of the chimpanzee genome showed that we're even more like us, that they're even more like us than we thought before. And it seems that we differ mostly in the expression of our genes, and that the expression of our genes can be affected by the environment in which we live. So here are these beings, so close to us in so many ways. You can get a blood transfusion from a chimpanzee if you match the blood group. The chimpanzee's immune system is so like ours that they're used by some scientists to find out more about the nature of the diseases and the cures and vaccines of those diseases which are otherwise uniquely human, unique to us and the other great apes anyway. And the brain of the chimpanzee, more like ours than that of any other living being, amazingly similar in its structure and anatomy. But one way in which we differ hugely, at least modern man and modern chimpanzee, is in the rate of reproduction. I've been now with my team studying the chimpanzees of Gombe for more than 45 years. And during that time, we've studied in particular one central community. And that community, the Kasekela community, has produced individuals that are actually known all around the world. The names Flo and Fifi, Mike, David, Greybeard, Goliath. I can go to South Korea. And even in North Korea, there are people who know those names and ask me how those particular chimpanzees are. Of course, they're all gone today, but Fifi only disappeared about 18 months ago, and she was my last link with the very early days in 1960. But throughout these 45 years, the population growth of that community has basically been zero. They have achieved zero population growth. The female has her first baby when she's 12 or 13. There's then typically a 5 or even 6 year birth space between live births. And there is a very high infant mortality. It's about 30% in the first 2 years of life. And so for the most part, a female, by the time she stops reproducing, which is when she's about 50 or over 50, There's no real menopause until age just makes it impossible for her to have babies. But by the time she dies, she's not likely to have raised more than two offspring to full reproductive status. And so that is the zero population. And if we look around the world today, we find that zero population isn't achieved in many communities. I think it's interesting too to look back to many of the communities in Africa where today we see a lot of overpopulation, to see how it used to be before the white man came. There was more or less zero population growth back then. And then the cultures of these people were changed, missionaries came in, people were taught that it was wrong to breastfeed their babies, for example. All kinds of changes occurred which started changing reproductive patterns. We all know the huge problems there are in any city town today with the overpopulation of dogs and cats. And we have solutions which range from spaying and neutering them to euthanizing them. That's how we deal with that. But we can't exactly do that to our human overpopulation. When I'm talking about the problems in the world today, I usually say the two main problems for me are, on the one hand, the vicious cycle of poverty and overpopulation and hunger and disease, and on the other hand, the unsustainable lifestyles of most of us in the developed world and certainly in the elite communities around the world. So there's this big difference today. I think, though, when I've talked about chimpanzees being more like us than any other living creature, I've sort of indicated that the female doesn't have that many children. What's fascinating is how like us the chimpanzee families are, in that they have affectionate, supportive bonds between family members and they can last throughout life. They have younger members of the family who will help care for infants, and particularly if the mother dies, an older brother or sister may care for that child. But I just wanted to tell you a couple of stories before moving into some of the serious issues that we face in the world today. Because maybe some people wonder, why are we still studying the chimpanzees after 45 years, and are we wasting money studying them, and why are we trying to preserve them? Well, first of all, let's imagine you're with me in the forest and we're following a young male in his prime. He's about 23 years old. His name is Satan. He suddenly, well, it's because when he was a kid, my mother had come to stay and he stole a manuscript she was working on. So we had to bribe him with a banana to get it back, but that was long ago. And now here he is, splendid young male, traveling alone as they so often do. And he hears sounds of chimpanzees feeding in a tree way along the trail, and that it's 20 of them or so doing that. It's very exciting. So his hair bristles and he hastens along the path and rushes up the tree, and he sees this huge tree with ripe fruits and feeding chimps, a ripe bunch of fruit. He aims for it. There's a younger chimpanzee feeding there, but that's okay, because Satan is dominant to this 19-year-old male, so he threatens him. And the young male moves away screaming, and Satan begins to feed. But what Satan didn't realize is that that young male's older brother is feeding higher in the branches. And hearing his kid brother scream, he comes swinging down, and the two brothers together start attacking Satan, so now he begins to scream. To my amazement, a very ancient female, very frail, with not much hair, with teeth worn, is feeding peacefully high up. But now she comes swinging down through the branches. She drops her frail self onto these three battling males, each of whom is at least twice as heavy as she is. And with her little fist, she starts hitting at the two brothers, who are so surprised, I think, that they threaten her mildly and Satan gets away. And that was his ancient mother. And it's just one illustration. Yes, as Malcolm said, there is a dark side to chimpanzee nature, as there is to ours. They are capable of war and brutality, but they are also capable of love, compassion, and altruism. And I think more than any other species, they have helped us to understand that there is no sharp line dividing us from the rest of the animal kingdom. It's a very fuzzy line, and getting fuzzier all the time when we find out that we differ genetically by only just over 1%. I mean, that makes you think. And then when you think about the brain, you think that chimpanzees can be taught more than 400 signs of ASL, American Sign Language for the deaf. You learn that some of them can use a computer and solve simple problems faster than high school students, faster than me. It makes you start to think, and it makes you have a new respect, perhaps. But it also makes us have a new respect for the other amazing animals with whom we share this kingdom. All those amazing creatures like the great whales deep down in the ocean communicating with their haunting songs, with birds who migrate for thousands and thousands of miles from one feeding ground to the breeding ground, the bats flying through the dark night echolocating. And then, of course, we have our beloved dogs, our cats, and the horses. And when we start thinking about the fact that there is not this sharp line between us and them, it raises a lot of ethical issues when we think how we treat our domestic animals and how we are slowly pushing to extinction more and more of the great and wonderful animals of the planet. Chimpanzees, there were about 2 million of them 100 years ago, stretched across the African continent in the equatorial forest belt. Well, there's no more than 200,000 of them today in 21 countries. Most likely it's only about 150,000. And it's the same with so many of the other animals, the elephants, the other great apes, monkeys, antelopes, some of the whales, some of the sharks. We could go on and on with this list of endangered species, let alone the ones who are disappearing every day, the small, seemingly insignificant insects, along with the small, seemingly insignificant plants that may in fact hold keys to vital problems of human health, but we're destroying them before we find out and before we even have identified them in some cases. So the chimpanzee teaching us that we're not the only being on the planet with personality, mind, and feeling has enabled us to think about this push to extinction of some of these amazing creatures in a different way. We're not just destroying a species, we're destroying individuals. Individual chimpanzees or elephants or dogs, they have a right to their life. Their life for them is full of meaning. Perhaps it has a meaning in the great scheme of things. So that when we're thinking about the threats to the life on this planet posed by our species, all the threats we've heard about this afternoon, then we start thinking also not just in terms of losing species, losing biodiversity, losing beings that might one day affect us if they disappear. We're thinking about losing and pushing to extinction sentient, sapient beings who have as much right on this planet as we have. If we think about the main difference between us and chimpanzees, for me, it's the fact that we have evolved a sophisticated spoken language, a language which enables us to teach our children about things which are not present, enables us to talk about the distant past and perhaps learn from it, to think about the distant future, to make plans for it, and above all, to discuss, so that a simple idea, when discussed by a little group, can change and change direction according to the wisdom, the knowledge, the insights of the people who are involved in that discussion. And it seems to me that this acquisition of this kind of language has perhaps been responsible for this explosive development of our brain. If we want to look at the intellectual accomplishments of humans, then they obviously are very different to the intellectual accomplishments of the other creatures, even those as like us as chimpanzees. We're not going to have a chimpanzee who's a Beethoven, who can build a cathedral, who will do a PhD, or even stand and give a lecture. We have differed from the other animals in this way. And so it's high time now that we use this incredible brain of ours to try and get ourselves out of the mess that we've made ourselves in. there are some lectures I give in some parts, particularly of this country, where people ask questions about creationism and evolution. And this is a very sensitive issue in some places. But I think the answer is very simple. It's fascinating to know how we came to be this extraordinary creature we are. But the most important thing is that we use the greatest asset we have, which is our brain, to find solutions to the problems that we've made. And what's happened? What do you suppose has happened? How is it that a creature that can put humans on the moon, can go out into space, can create the most extraordinary technology? I mean, my mother lived an extra 20 years because of medical technology that saved her life when she was 70. And many of us probably know of people who've been saved by modern medical miracles. And we've built great cathedrals, we've written books, we've done so many extraordinary things. So how is it that we are making decisions today, some of which involve the use of destructive technologies, some of which are leading to the global warming, the global climate change, leading to acid rain, all these things that have been talked about this afternoon, leading to the draining of the aquifers and the polluting of what's left? How is it that for all these years, since Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring, we've continued to throw chemicals onto the environment to grow our food? We've poisoned it. We've poisoned the food that we eat. And how is it that we've allowed a situation to arise where children in so many parts of the world get sick from the food they eat or the water they drink or the air they breathe? What's happened? And I think if we go back to many of the old indigenous ways, we hear from different parts of the world that when they had a major decision to make, they would gather the elders, and the elders would sit down and discuss this back and forth, sometimes deliberating for hours or even days. And in the end, they would make a decision based on how does this decision affect our people 7 generations ahead. I would love it if today we would make decisions in high places based on how does this affect our people 1 generation ahead, instead of how does this decision affect the next shareholders meeting. And how is it that we as intelligent citizens of the planet allow ourselves to be so poisoned, to be so polluted, to be so deluded? Where are our voices? It was when I began to realize, as I traveled in Africa, starting in 1986, because I suddenly realized that chimpanzees were disappearing, including the famous Gombe chimpanzees, and I began traveling in Africa talking about the plight of the chimps. Finding some solutions, yes, Mary has talked eloquently about our Takari or Take Care program, and it is changing lives, and hopefully with the greater Gombe ecosystem, we will be able to build leafy corridors which will enable the chimps who today are trapped, and from 150 individuals who lived there in 1960, these 3 communities of 50 each, only the central community where we've been working has remained at about 50. The other 2 have shrunk to almost nothing. And they've been separated from other remnant groups by these cultivated fields, the fields that Mary showed in the slide, where the cultivation of these very steep slopes has led to increased soil erosion, poverty, famine, struggling to live. But we hope that now, with farmers agreeing to leave 10 to 20% of their land to remain for conservation, that we can create these leafy corridors for the chimpanzees to move out and interact with other remnant groups. And that's their only hope, because in chimpanzee society, it's the young females who move out of the community and interact and breed with males of neighboring communities. That's what prevents too much inbreeding. And they haven't been able to do that for the past 15 years or so. One of the great innovative conservation helps that's happened recently is that we find, fortunately, all around the hills of Gombe is grown the most exquisite coffee, some of the best, if not the best, in Tanzania. So when I was talking to the International Specialty Coffee Association last year in Seattle, I said, you know, the farmers can't get their coffee to the market because they're too remote, too isolated. By the time they get it to the auctions in Arusha, they can't really make any money. So all the coffee was lumped and the good coffee was lost in this less good coffee that's grown in different parts. So as a result of that, some of the big coffee buyers and coffee growers and coffee roasters have said that they want to help us to create a specialty brand which will enable the farmers to get really good price for their money, and also to help the chimpanzees, so that a percentage will come to us to help to create these leafy corridors. So now you see why it's so important that over the years that Take Care program has been in operation with amazing people like Mary, and they're all Tanzanians, this team. It's because of this build-up of trust that now the farmers are saying, well, okay, you're helping us. And the village is saying, you're helping the village. So, okay, you can have 10 or 20% of the land, and they don't have to choose the best land. And we can, wherever possible, flank these corridors with coffee plantations, because chimps don't like coffee. And so it's a brilliant conservation tool. And it's part of improving the economy of the area. And as we've seen all around the world, typically as women's education and empowerment increases, we do see lowering of family size. So that's a solution. But it's, you know, it's one tiny bit of Africa, and apes are disappearing everywhere. So I was traveling around and talking to people about the problems facing the apes, and talking about conservation and encouraging people to have conservation awareness weeks. And, you know, the more I traveled in Africa, the more I saw of Africa's problems, seeing about the increased droughts and the resulting famine, seeing the floods that were getting worse because of soil erosion, seeing the poverty and the suffering, seeing these communities where the children get more and more, and quite clearly the parents are having a hard job to feed them, and seeing areas which I remembered as being forest being destroyed by logging companies coming in from outside, seeing areas where there was rich local cultivation of farmland being taken over for huge areas where foreign multinationals could come in and put in their kind of farming and grow wheat, so that the local cultures were slowly being pushed out, and the customs and traditions which led to those cultures being gradually lost. And I realized increasingly that so many of Africa's problems could be laid directly at the non-sustainable lifestyles of the elite communities around the world, and in particular parts of Europe and the United States. So I began traveling also talking about these issues outside Africa. And the more I traveled, the further I went, the more did I meet young people, students, university students, like many of you here tonight, and also high school students, thoughtful young people, and people who've left university too. And I found that so many of them had lost hope. It's not just in the villages where the poor people live, like Mary was talking about, who are ground into the soil by poverty and suffering. It's also those young people who have opportunity for learning. And so why were they looking depressed? Why were they apathetic and not caring? Why were they bitter, angry, and sometimes violent? And the more young people I met like this, the more I began talking to them. And basically they all said more or less the same thing. We feel this way because we feel that your generation has compromised our future. The world is spiraling out of control. We feel helpless. We feel there's nothing we can do. And they're right. That's exactly what we've done. And if I look at my three little grandchildren and my sisters too, I think how much we've harmed the world since I was their age. I feel a deep shame. And by the way, I've got three grandchildren, but let me tell you, my grandmother had four children. Only one produced two children, which is me and my sister. Between us, we've produced three children, and between us we have 4 grandchildren. So I think in the population score we haven't done too badly. We've done pretty chimp-like. Anyway, so this was one of the factors that led to the Jane Goodall Institute developing its program for youth. This is a program that we call Roots and Shoots. It's a symbolic name. Roots make a firm foundation. Shoots seem tiny, but to reach the sun, they can break through a brick wall. And if we see the brick wall as all the problems that we've inflicted on this planet, all the ones we've been talking about today and all the ones we haven't, I mean, we all know how many problems there are, the cruelty and the greed, the crime, the drugs, the terrorism, the threat of renewed threat of nuclear war, all of this stuff. It's a thick, daunting wall, but hundreds and thousands of young people, the roots and shoots of the world, can break through and can make this a better world. I may be naive to have hope, but I feel that my mission is to give hope to the hopeless, because without hope, there is no hope. If all our young people around the world give up and say it's hopeless, then it is hopeless. So the main message of Roots and Shoots is that every individual makes a difference every day. We cannot live through this world without making an impact, and we all have a choice as to what impact we're going to make. And that relates to things like what we eat, where did it come from, how was it made? Do the clothes we buy come from child slave labor in China? We can make choices as to how many children we have. We have these choices every single day. And so often, we don't spend the time to think about them. We don't really feel concerned about where our food comes from, where our clothes come from, how we get from A to B. And so this is one of the main aspects of Roots and Shoots. Every individual makes a difference every day. And Roots and Shoots is beginning to empower young people. And when you're empowered, then you start to get hope. And when you care about the future, you're more likely to make the wise decisions, which themselves will change the future when they're multiplied by people around the world. So what do Roots and Shoots do? They choose 3 different kinds of projects, and it's very youth-driven. It began in Tanzania with 18 high school students on the veranda of my house, and they went back to their different schools. There were 9 schools, and they started a little club in each school. And the goal, choose 3 different kinds of project to make the world a better place. First of all, a project that will actually help your own human community. So what are you going to do? Well, is there homelessness? Are there street children? Can you help people in a rural area who are sick and can't till their fields? And that is a terrible problem in Africa today because of the AIDS pandemic. There are many families where there's only children left and the fields can't be harvested and people are starving because of that. There are projects visiting old people who've been kind of abandoned in assisted living and they don't have many friends anymore, and we can go and give them some excitement in their lives, talk to them, give them a party, listen to their stories, record oral history, work with orphans. Bring the two together, the orphans and the old people. It works like magic. Both then have a meaning for their lives. The second kind of project is to make things better for animals, partly awareness of wildlife problems. Can we do anything to save extinction or to protect endangered species or even to restore them? But what about our dogs and our cats? What about these dogs and cats roaming on the streets, homeless like the children? What about the hundreds and thousands of animals crushed into conditions which for them are like concentration camps, because as people become affluent and want more meat, and people want to create cheap meat, to give them meat to make money, so we have animals living in unspeakably horrendous conditions. And just for a moment, let me backtrack there, because even if people say, well, I don't care if cows and pigs are suffering, they don't feel, they're not humans, they're just there for us. Even if people feel that, think about it this way, that in order to raise the meat quickly so that the farmers can make as much money as possible. It's this big agribusiness. They pump them full of hormones very often so that the meat grows more fast. But to keep them alive, and this is the real bad thing, to keep them alive in these horrible, cramped conditions, you have to feed them antibiotics quite regularly, otherwise they're going to die of all kinds of different things. Their immune systems are just, hope, you know, they're shot, they're completely destroyed. So that means that the antibiotics have come out into the human food chain. That means the bacteria are building up resistance. When you hear about killer bugs, people have already died from one scratch on a finger for which there was no known antibiotic. So we're breeding up a terrible future for ourselves. There's a book called The Killer Within, written by a friend of mine, Mark Plotkin. And if you read that book, it's pretty scary. But so Roots and Shoots groups are working on that kind of thing, working to raise awareness, because most people don't know how their food is raised. And the third kind of project is to make the world better for the environment that we all share. We share it with the animals, it's Mother Earth, it's what sustained us, it's what through because of Mother Earth that we are who we are.
A speech given by the world-renowned chimpanzee expert Jane Goodall as part of the Bixby series, the title is Population and Conservation, was given in 2006 on May the 6th.